Thursday, October 1st, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Sarah Williams in Washington. Coming up, Russia launches a second day of airstrikes in Syria, reportedly targeting rebels. We'll get some analysis.
Vladimir Putin is emphatically saying to anyone, particularly those countries that are back in the opposition, the Syrian opposition, that Russia is not going to let the Syrian regime collapse.
Afghanistan says its forces have recaptured parts of Kunduz, but the Taliban disputes the claim. And we'll hear how an actress is now pursuing a musical career. It's all ahead. Russia on Thursday launched a second day of airstrikes in Syria, reportedly aimed at rebels. U.S. Defense Secretary Ashton Carter called Russia's military intervention in Syria, purportedly to target the Islamic State, a logical contradiction in Moscow's policy, and warned Wednesday it will only inflame the nearly five-year-old conflict.
Russia states an intent to fight ISIL, on the one hand, and to support Bashar al-Assad and his regime, on the other. Fighting ISIL without pursuing a parallel political transition only risks escalating the civil war in Syria, and with it, the very extremism and instability that Moscow claims to be concerned about and aspire to fighting. So that approach is tantamount to pouring gasoline on the fire. And in contrast, our position is clear, that a lasting defeat of ISIL and extremism in Syria can only be achieved in parallel with a political transition in Syria. And we will continue to insist on the importance of simultaneously pursuing these two objectives. Now, I would hope that Russia would join us in pursuing these objectives, which they claim to share, in parallel rather than in a sequence that cannot succeed.
U.S. defense officials say Russian aircraft struck targets near the western city of Homs, and Carter said the operation involved places where, in fact, the IS group is not present. Russian President Vladimir Putin said the strikes had come at the formal request of Syrian leader Bashar al-Assad and will continue as long as the Syrian army is on the offensive. Mr. Putin said Russia will support the Syrian army only in its legitimate fight, specifically against terrorist groups. Syria analyst David Lesh of Trinity University in Texas tells VOA's Victor Beatty Moscow has clearly taken the initiative in Syria.
Vladimir Putin is emphatically saying to anyone, particularly those countries that are back in the opposition, the Syrian opposition, that Russia is not going to let the Syrian regime collapse. So if any of these countries want to continue to back opposition groups, whether they be Jabhat al-Nusra, ISIS, or legitimate Syrian opposition, you better ante up and be prepared to be in it for the long haul. Otherwise, shift your efforts to bring an end to the conflict by backing the Syrian government, which, you know, would put everyone, from the Russian point of view, in a better position to take on the Islamic State and, you know, possibly ameliorate the refugee problem. Secondly, I think it's an attempt to secure Russian long-held strategic interests in Syria and, importantly, secure a seat at the diplomatic table in any sort of political process that may develop regarding a negotiated settlement. And Putin wants to make Russia an indispensable partner in the future of Syria, which would enable Moscow to secure and even improve its strategic position in the region.
According to media reports, perhaps as many as 36 people, maybe more, were killed in the Russian airstrikes. The Defense Secretary, Ashton Carter, suggested at his news briefing on Wednesday the Russian targets apparently were non-Islamic State.
Russians are adopting the definition of terrorists that the Syrian regime has long taken. That is, anyone who's fighting the Syrian regime are terrorists. I think although the Russians would like everyone to think they're attacking the Islamic State, they know that in the immediate term, the biggest threat to the Syrian regime, and therefore the biggest threat to Russian interests, are the reconstituted Syrian opposition groups, particularly a group called Jaish al-Fatah, or the Army of Conquest, which has experienced a number of victories against Syrian government forces over the last 6 months. And that's why they're hitting north of Homs, because that's where some of their forces are located.
Is the United States just going to allow the Russians to take the initiative in Syria?
Well, I think the U.S. can't really do anything about it right now. So, you know, for now, it's cautiously going along for the ride to see where this may go, particularly in terms of if it energizes or generates another attempt at diplomacy to reach a political settlement. I think we're hoping that the Russians are acting in, you know, less in self-interested strategic reasons in the short term and are thinking about the long term and holding the Russians to their word that, you know, when they say they want a negotiated solution and they want Bashar al-Assad to make the necessary reforms and that Syria has to be a different country in the future. Yeah, I think we're going to let them see if they can bring this about, because certainly no one else can. And so right now, I think the U.S. is staying on the sidelines, even though some U.S. officials, I think, are kind of like, fine, go ahead, Russians, try to do what you can, but you're going to get caught up in this quagmire that we've been avoiding all this time, and we'll be laughing in the end.
That's David Lesh of Trinity University in Texas. He says Russian military action will do nothing to advance a political solution in Syria as long as it's targeting legitimate opposition groups. Lesh says Moscow may use its military to force the opposition to conclude it has no chance of winning militarily and must come to the negotiating table. Ironically, he says it may also empower Mr. Assad to hang on and refuse concessions because he's now in a stronger position. Well, joining me here in the studio is social media editor Andrew Pelshevsky. So, Andrew, what is the reaction to this Russian airstrikes in Syria?
Well, the reaction on social media ranges from skepticism to an outright rejection of what Russia's doing. And you're seeing a lot of opinions from U.S. political leaders. A lot of people are sharing that quote that we heard from Secretary Ashton Carter saying that it's like pouring gas on a fire. Senator Rand Paul also calling Vladimir Putin an evil man. So a lot of strong opinions about what Russia's doing, strong condemnation across social media for these actions in Syria. Today is a big day in Nigeria. Hashtag Nigeria at 55 is trending. It's the 55th Independence Day in Nigeria, so a lot of people are celebrating that, thinking about what they want to see from their country in the future, hopes for the future, and where the country could go forward, where the country might be able to do better with some things like gay rights, for example. People have been sharing things like that. But a lot of celebration, a lot of photos of some of the celebrations, President Buhari attending some of those in Nigeria. So happy Independence Day to our Nigerian listeners. Today is also World Vegetarian Day, so hashtag World Vegetarian Day is trending. My favorite thing that I've seen so far this morning is someone made a picture of Paul McCartney, noted vegan, vegetarian, animal rights activist, and made it out of vegetables as face. So that was, I thought, was quite a nice way to celebrate the day. But a lot of people sharing recipes, saying, you know, why they don't eat meat, whether it's for environmental reasons or animal cruelty reasons. But a lot of interesting things being shared about that, and recipes too. So I'm going to have to go through and see what recipes. I might have some good ideas for dinner tonight.
Yeah, I remember McCartney's late wife Linda published, I think, at least one, if not more, vegetarian cookbooks.
Oh, absolutely. And I wouldn't be surprised to see people sharing maybe some of Sir Paul McCartney's recipes, and maybe even himself sharing some of his favorite recipes on social media today. And then finally, we have hashtag people, P-E-E-P-L-E, trending. Now, this is apparently an app that's being created or has been created where you will be able to rate people, much like you can rate businesses on apps like Yelp. This would allow you to rate people. So a lot of people comparing it to the movie Mean Girls, which came out about 10 years ago. They had a thing called the Burn Book where they wrote down mean things about people in their high school class. So,
well, is this personal or professional?
So that's the thing. It's, you know, people are saying that it's going to be interesting to see how it is used, and a lot of speculation on social media saying this sounds like maybe a bad idea. So more to follow on that, I'm sure, as that app comes out, we'll see. But hopefully people's feelings don't get hurt and they use it, like you said, hopefully professionally and not personally.
Okay, thanks very much, Andrew. That's social media editor Andrew Pelshevsky. Afghanistan says its forces have recaptured parts of Kunduz from Taliban fighters after what officials have described as heavy fighting. I'm joined now by reporter Ayaz Ghul, who is in Islamabad, Pakistan. Ayaz, this is certainly a very fluid situation, but at the moment, is it known who really is in control of Kunduz?
Well, we have two different versions about the actual situation in the city. One is from the government side and the Interior Ministry, and then the Deputy Army Chief of Afghan Forces this morning announced that as a result of the overnight counteroffensive that was launched to recapture the city, has pushed the Taliban from certain parts of the city out, basically driven them out, and that they are now in control of key installations, including the prison and the police headquarters and other buildings. But then from the Taliban side, they are claiming And this is what, in fact, residents in Kunduz have also confirmed, that the insurgents are still in control of a substantial part of the city, and intense clashes are going on. And just let me tell you that while the government side, the interior ministry, the military officials have announced that they are advancing and they have captured much of the city, the Speaker of the Afghan Parliament, Abdul Rauf Ibrahimi, addressed a press conference a little while ago in Kabul. And when he was posed this question as to exactly who is in control of the Kunduz city, he was really not specific, and he said that it is very difficult to say exactly which part is under the government control and which part the Taliban is controlling. But he did admit that, you know, the situation remains fluid, and it is not clear whether the government has taken control of most of the city. And he went on to just say that in a warlike situation, a retreat and victory is part of the game, which shows that, you know, he's an influential man in the administration in Kabul, very closely linked with the Kabul administration. So if he's making these vague statements, it clearly shows that the government is not in clear control of the city. But we're expecting that President Ashraf Ghani, who is expected, who is scheduled to address a press conference in the Afghan capital later this evening, that we will have a clear situation about the military advancement that the government forces have made as of at this moment.
Now, apparently, President Ashraf Ghani is facing some opposition. Apparently, protesters have gathered in Kabul because they're upset with what they perceive as the government's failure to provide security to the citizens of Kunduz.
Well, yes, this was quite a big demonstration that we witnessed in Kabul this morning. And there were women and men participating in this protest rally. And they were obviously demanding that President Ghani and his administration should step down because they were unable to deliver on their commitments to provide security to Afghan citizens. But at the same time, the government spokespeople have been defending the situation, saying that the delay and the slow operation is primarily to make sure that there are no civilian casualties in the Kunduz city, because as the government has insisted since the beginning that Taliban fighters have taken refuge in civilian areas and homes, and that has what, you know, prevented Afghan Air Force from bombing Taliban positions in the city and, you know, storming the city in a way that to drive them out quickly.
All right, well, thank you very much, Ayaz. That's Ayaz Ghul reporting from Islamabad. This is VOA.
Here's Science in a Minute.
2, 1, 0, +1, +2, +3, +4, +5.
India recently launched its first space observatory from the Satish Dhawan Space Center at Sriharikota. Called the Astrosat, the new astronomical satellite will provide scientists the ability to examine cosmic objects not only in visible light, but also in the ultraviolet and X-ray waveband. Celestial bodies such as stars, galaxies, black holes, neutron stars, white dwarfs, and quasars produce energy across a wide range of wavelengths, and the Astrosat will allow scientists to look at these objects from multiple wavelengths simultaneously. Indian space officials say they hope that their new satellite will produce cutting-edge research in astrophysics. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
This is International Edition on the Voice of America. I'm Sarah Williams. Coming up, actress Hailee Steinfeld turns her attention towards music. In the space of a few months, the foundations of the European Union have been rocked by twin crises: the political chaos sparked by Greece's economic woes and the influx of hundreds of thousands of migrants and refugees. As Henry Ridgewell reports from London, some analysts say the EU itself now faces an existential threat.
In July, the economic and political turmoil in Greece reached its peak as voters rejected the terms of an EU bailout in a referendum. Under pressure from Brussels, Prime Minister Alexis Tsipras defied the result and signed on to the deal, severely undermining trust in the EU, says historian Andrea Mamone of Royal Holloway University in London.
A politician from another nation, a minister from another nation saying, you have to vote for this, you have to vote for that. So why? Where is the democratic legitimacy of all that?
In the following weeks, a wave of hundreds of thousands of migrants arrived on Europe's shores, and the numbers continue to build. Europe was accused of indifference to the refugees' plight. A lack of European solidarity has been exposed, says Mamone.
A fracture between among states and within states, population with the outsiders being other European nations, other European people, and especially today in some nations more than in others, migrants coming from other areas of the world.
The answer does not lie in breaking up the union, argues Christian Odendahl of the London-based Centre for European Reform.
The refugee crisis requires a common European response, and it's not the fault of the European Union. To the extent that national democracies are not capable to deliver the responses needed, for instance, in the economic crisis, we need more integration.
30 years ago, five EU states signed the Schengen Agreement that created a passport-free travel zone, which has since expanded across 26 European states. But that core EU principle of freedom of movement is being tested as several countries reintroduce border checks to counter the migrant surge. Hungary has built razor wire fences along its southern borders. That was surprising, says James Kerlinsey of the London School of Economics.
Schengen was one of the great advances that the European Union made, this idea of free movement, that you'd have open borders, and to see it, these fences going up, I think that this came as a very real shock.
On the horizon lie yet more threats. Britain will hold a vote on leaving the EU before 2018, with recent opinion polls favouring an exit. Analysts say such a result could prove fatal for the union itself. Henry Ridgewell for VOA News, London.
This is VOA.
Hashtag VOA. It's a weekly show, Tuesdays at 1730 UTC, where we bring you the top topics of the week. But the show lives on social media every day with your daily video shorts, What's Trending Wednesday, and the Friday Fast Five. Subscribe to the show at YouTube. You can find us at hashtag VOA. You can reach me at Twitter, at Perry Cal, or talk to the show anytime. Please don't forget to like us on Facebook. We like to be liked. We love to be seen. And you can reach us anytime.
Hi, my name's Larry London. Welcome to Border Crossings, your request and dedication program here at the Voice of America. 1500 Universal, Monday through Friday, we're there for an hour playing your favorite music. You can send an email in and request your favorite songs by your favorite artist. You can also phone in as well. We have great contests and surprise guests from time to time. Border Crossings, every single day during the week at 1500 Universal, here on the Voice of America.
This is International Edition. A popular young actress is making a career move, sort of. Hailee Steinfeld is going to give the music industry a chance to see what she can do. International Edition's Jim Stevenson talked with VOA music expert Ray McDonald all about it.
Wow, how unique is that, huh? But Hailee Steinfeld has already shown us that she knows how to sing. She's an 18-year-old actress-singer. She's from Los Angeles. And even if her singing and acting career goes kaput, which it probably won't, she still has a bright future in personal training because her father is a personal trainer, as is her uncle, Jake Steinfeld. And if you're a student of popular culture here in the U.S., you may remember about 20 years ago, Jake Steinfeld founded a personal fitness empire under the Body by Jake brand. Mm. And so Hailee is her, his niece.
Yeah. When I get chills at night, I feel it deep inside without you. Yeah. Know how to satisfy, keeping the tempo right without you.
about you. Yeah.
She began acting at a very young age. She was 8 years old. At 13, she played Mattie Ross in the remake of the Western True Grit. That earned her a nomination for Best Supporting Actress at the age of 13. Not bad. In 2013, she was in the sci-fi adventure Ender's Game. And earlier this year, Haley starred in Pitch Perfect 2. The Pitch Perfect franchise is turning into a big hit. Movie made a lot of money. She sang a Jessie J song, Flashlight. And Pitch Perfect 3 will be coming out in 2017, and Haley is also in that.
Yeah. Got me speaking in tongues, the beautiful it comes without you. Yeah.
Now, after Pitch Perfect 2 was a big hit, Republic Records came calling with a record contract. Haley is making her debut album, which she says she can't wait for us to hear because it's going to surprise a lot of people. And we already know about the first hit single. It's called Love Myself. It was released on August 7th, and it's currently rising in 30th place on the latest Billboard Hot 100 singles chart.
And that sounds so good, Ray. Haley, obviously, is going to have a bright future in front of her at the tender age of 18.
Well, she certainly knows what to do. I mean, she's been around showbiz figures all her life. I think she's pretty well prepared for what comes next.
Be sure to follow Ray on Twitter, Ray on the Hits, and also his countdowns right here on The Voice of America. Ray, thanks so much for stopping by.
Thank you, Jim.
That's our show for today. I'm Sarah Williams. Thanks so much for joining us.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
In a blatant violation of international humanitarian law, self-declared authorities in the separatist-controlled Luhansk region of eastern Ukraine have ordered 10 of 11 international humanitarian aid organizations to cease operations and leave the area within 2 days after the notification. Included among these are a number of United Nations aid agencies, as well as non-governmental humanitarian organizations such as France's Doctors Without Borders, Czech Republic's People in Need, and the International Rescue Committee. Only the International Red Cross will be allowed to resume work, but only after signing an agreement dictated by the separatists. In the wake of Russia's move to illegally annex Ukraine's Crimean Peninsula, Russian-backed separatists staged an uprising in eastern Ukraine, and for the past 17 months have been fighting Ukrainian government forces attempting to dislodge them from the Donbas. As a result, some 8,000 people have since been killed, and well over 2 million have been displaced, about 1.4 million of them internally. According to the United Nations, as many as 5 million Ukrainians are in need of assistance today, particularly now as winter approaches. But as a result of last month's ban, some 3 million of them will not receive the supplies and services they need. A delivery of 16,000 tons of humanitarian assistance is being blocked from those in need. This means that 150,000 people will have to do without their monthly food allotments, while some 30,000 will wait in vain for shelter materials and household items they urgently need. 1.3 million are at risk of losing access to potable water. There will be no essential medicines such as insulin and tuberculosis vaccines, no anesthesia to perform life-saving surgery. The United States calls on the Russia-backed separatists to take immediate steps to improve the lives of the very people they claim to care about most by allowing humanitarian organizations unrestricted access and facilitating the provision of desperately needed assistance now to all those who are suffering, said State Department spokesperson John Kirby in a written statement. Russia and the separatists it backs must fulfill their obligations under the Minsk agreements and allow unimpeded access to all areas of Ukraine by international humanitarian organizations.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.